Professor Harris's Entertainment Law, 6 November 2008.
Recording of a song, put it in the soundtrack, you will have two clearances that you will have to worry about. One is a right to utilize the music in the film, and the second would be to go to the record company, whoever owns the copyright in the sound recording, and get their rights as well. Yes?
So if you get the right to the music, you still have to go further to its originator, of the song, the writer of the composition.
Yes, or the music publisher to get the rights to use the song, then you have to go to the record company to get the rights to use that particular recording of the song if you're devoted to that particular recording as opposed to another recording. Is everybody clear on that? The document, one of the handouts I gave you, Gesundheit, is a summary called the Music Rights Primer that was put out by the Entertainment Law Committee of the Bar Association of the City of New York. It was the time I was chairman of the committee. We issued this. It's a very good summary of the music terminology and begins with this distinction between a sound recording copyright and a music copyright. I also gave you a very short piece of an opinion, the Stumm opinion, which again makes very clear that there are two separate copyrights that we're dealing with here. Okay, let's go on now then to talk about music. We could have music alone or music with lyrics, and then Gesundheit, a possible collaboration, because music and lyrics together may be what kind of a work? Yes. Good. A joint work under copyright. That's a term you, of course, remember very well, right? Yes, you should. Okay. Now, if you have a collaboration on a joint work, as you say, you may well need and should have a collaboration agreement setting forth the respective rights of the composer and lyricist if they are two different people. Obviously, if the composer and lyricist are one and the same person, you don't need a collaboration agreement with yourself. That's maybe you're schizophrenic, but otherwise you don't. Okay. Publishing rights. And this is where a lot of the terminology is going to come in. What rights do you have in a music copyright? And these usually include the right to perform, the right to copy, the right to put it into a new work or a derivative work. But they have industry-type names and distinctions, and that's what we're going to spend about the next half hour doing. The first is the mechanical right. We need a little history to understand what a mechanical right is. Okay. The mechanical right is the right to reproduce and distribute to the public a copyrighted musical composition on phono recordings, sound recordings, okay? Tapes, discs, or any other way where you can listen to the sounds. So it's the right to put the song onto, let's use CD for simplicity purpose, to record that song on a CD. That is a mechanical license. Now, here's why it's called that, and here's some history. Copyright law has, other than print rights, sheet music, not always protected composers against the making of other than print copies. Back in 1908, a century ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case called White Smith versus Apollo that player piano rolls, remember those with the little holes punched in them and you turn it on and it makes the keys on the piano move, those piano rolls did not infringe the copyright in the musical composition. The court held that based on the copyright law in effect at that time, that perforated rolls that produced music were not copies, since even an expert musician could not see or read it by looking at the holes in the paper. It's almost like a computer. It's like looking at computer code, and nobody can say what it's going to sound like. Sheet music, where you put the notes on the sheet with the bars and the staff, okay, that's a copy. But not the mechanical reproduction of songs on perforated rolls. Now you're seeing the source of the term mechanical. Okay, put that in your pocket. Music composers began immediately lobbying Congress for reform. The player piano and record industries were growing rapidly, and after the Supreme Court decision, everybody was free to copy whatever they pleased without paying the composers and lyricists for the music. But Congress was worried about something else at the time, and which may have influenced their decision. There was one particular company that was gaining a monopoly in the player role industry, and that was the Aeolian Company. And they were buying up, anticipating that there might be a right to this. They were buying up from composers left and right, give me the rights on perforated rolls. If Congress then enacted protection, it would essentially give the Aeolian Company a monopoly in the industry. And so therefore, the composers got hurt when the Supreme Court decided that there was no copyright in the perforated rolls. So then Congress took up the issue and said, well, how are we going to reconcile? You know, the composers need copyright. We're worried about monopoly. So they created what was then known as a statutory license, meaning everybody can do this. And they passed a law that says anybody can make this type of copy if they pay 2 cents to the composer for each copy they made. Back in the 1909 copyright law. So once a song is recorded and released, or printed and released, everybody out there can make their own piano roll version as long as they pay 2 cents to the copyright owner. And that was known as a statutory license, meaning the copyright statute gave you this right. And this was known as a statutory mechanical license. Again, mechanical because it was a machine part, this perforated roll, that when it was moved, created music. Okay? That rate, by the way, of 2 cents per copy, eventually applied to records when the record industry developed and supplanted the piano roll industry. The 2 cents rate remained in effect until 1978. It ruled for 68 years. Now, record companies didn't want the hassle of having to go to each copyright owner every time and take care of all and get the statutory license or go through the copyright office. So what did they do? The music publishers set up a branch called the Harry Fox Office. And the Harry Fox Office became a clearinghouse from a very large portion of music. So instead of having to fill out forms and get a statutory license, you would contact the Harry Fox office and say, I want a mechanical royalty for this song. They would have a sheet of paper. They quote you the rate, usually the statutory rate, although you could negotiate it. And you would get the license through this agency as a clearinghouse. And it's used today. Today, by the way, the mechanical royalty is 9.1 cents. A copy. That's where it's at now. And that probably will be reviewed by the shortly. It's been going up gradually year by year, and it's now up to 9.1 cents. This is summarized also in the primer on pages 2 and 3. Any questions about the mechanical royalty? Again, the different thing you're going to see when we talk about some of the other types of music rights, this is one in which Congress legislated that once a song is recorded, anybody else can make their own version of the recording, the good type, by paying a mechanical royalty. Or alternatively, if you want to bother me with the Harry Fox office, maybe you can get a better rate. Sometimes you can. So that's one very valuable right under music publishing. Next is the synchronization license. Anybody want to take a stab? What's a synchronization license? Yes?
It's just obtaining the right to air the publishing rights on television.
Yes, in other words, it's the right to take a musical composition and put it on the soundtrack of an audiovisual production. It's called synchronization because you have to synchronize the movement of the sound on the song into the sound roll of the particular audiovisual production. You know, when film is shot, there is a camera that takes silent film, then there's a separate audio track, and part of the stuff that goes on in post-production is to mix the two. So you have to synchronize the composition into the thing. It's also referred to more colloquially as a sync license. Not S-I-N-C, or not S-I-N-K, not just syncing it, but S-Y-N-C, short for synchronization. Now, a major difference between this license and the mechanical license is that there is no statutory obligation to grant such a license, which means two things. One, I can say no. I don't want my song being used in your television program. Or two, okay, but I'll name my price. And if you don't like it, don't use it. So there's free bargaining there. There's no statutory rate and no statutory obligation to allow a synchronization license. Yes?
So if someone is just mouthing a song or singing a song that doesn't belong to them,
yes,
and they're sitting in a documentary and they're talking and they just go into a little diddly, it's not a sync license that one would seek. It would be a sync.
Yes,
license,
absolutely a sync.
Okay.
Absolutely a sync license.
Yes. There's no fair use in this?
There may be. Now we're going back to copyright fair use, depending on how much you use and how you use it. The fair use argument may conceivably always be raised. But remember, fair use is a defense to what would otherwise be copyright infringement. You have to have the right. So what's the right that I'm establishing? It's a synchronization right. Maybe there's a fair use defense under the circumstances. But right now I'm trying to give you what the right is we're talking about.
Ms. Thorne's hypothetical just seemed like, you know, just mounting a song.
It may be. Maybe not.
And you didn't want to take that chance.
Maybe. Maybe not.
There's no flat rate, right?
No. No flat rate for synchronization license. Completely negotiable. Any other questions on the sync?
Yeah, no.
Yes, no, maybe.
My question, you may not have gotten me. I'm trying to force what my question is. I'm going to be two categories, and maybe it's not. What about the situation where political candidates use music? I know we talked about that actually.
That would be an infringement unless it's cleared. Yes. But that depends. We're not talking about a sync unless you're putting it into a commercial, which is an audiovisual work, or you're putting it into a movie or an infomercial. Okay, if it's being performed and not being recorded, it may violate another license, another right under the music copyright, which we're going to come to as you're patiently waiting in the next minute or two.
Okay.
Next is the print right, the right to do sheet music. At one time, of course, this was much more important, but with media today, we've gone well beyond print. Print is used if you need to, you know, for playing the piano, you need to get piano copies or orchestral parts, things of that are written down. There is not that much money in it today as there used to be. It's not as important compared to the mechanical and the performing rights we're going to talk about. That's also negotiable. You know, there are companies out there that do this, and, you know, there are obviously industry parameters, but there's no obligation on your part to allow anybody to make copies of your music. And you can negotiate whatever price you want. Okay, now we're going to spend a bit of time on the performance right, because that is an extraordinarily valuable right and has quite a history to it. The right to publicly perform the musical composition. And we need some history here. Performance rights in music first became part of the copyright law in 1897. The development of radio soon made performance royalties the primary source of composer revenue, surpassing sheet music sales that predominated in the 19th century. Okay. But the legal right was not self-enforcing. Those who performed copyrighted music for profit were so numerous and widespread, and most performances were so fleeting, that as a practical matter, it was impossible to find them, or if you had a very honest and moral band, to try to find and clear rights to all your music. I mean, if you're out in Dodge City, in the saloon, with gunslingers going down the streets, and there's music playing on a honky-tonk piano in the saloon, they weren't going to go out and look and find who the copyright owners were. The copyright owner wasn't going traveling around the country in a stagecoach trying to find every bar and saloon and restaurant and concert hall and parlor where music was being played. So for all practical purposes, the right was unenforceable. Okay? It was another, you couldn't avoid, nobody could get paid for it, nobody could police it. It looked like a lousy right. As it turns out, we'll see in a minute, it became the most valuable thing that ever happened in music copyright, and still is to this day. So what happened? Composers, realizing this problem, band together in 1914, in a collective licensing organization by the name of, anybody? No? Good try. Second hour of the class, yes. ASCAP. The American Society of Composers, authors there means the lyricists, and publishers. ASCAP. A-S-C-A-P. ASCAP expanded its role from enforcing performances rights to licensing them. And by the late 1930s, they were so powerful that they were even turning off some of the users, and they formed a competitive organization called BMI, Broadcast Music Inc., which was owned by, and still owned by, the broadcast industry. It has twice the number of members, by the way, of composer members as ASCAP today. They're called affiliates, not members of that organization, but I believe ASCAP has more songs in its catalog, like 3 million versus 2 million. Essentially, this was a brilliant, brilliant idea. These organizations became enormously powerful because what it did is it set up two wonderful things for composers. One, it set up an organization that had the ability to go out and monitor what's going on, to go to radio stations, to go to principal halls, and find out where music was being played and say, hey, do you have a license? If not, I'm going to sue you. And secondly, it became a clearinghouse on behalf of these composers and lyricists, because everybody knew you need to get your license so you don't get sued. Call up ASCAP. Call up BMI later. And they even offered things like, you know, you don't want to have to bother and call me every time. Get yourself a blanket license. License everything we own. And then you don't have to call us too often. And we'll go into that in a moment. So they became very important. Then, by the way, there's a third privately owned body that emerged called CESAC. S-E-S-A-C, the Society of European Stage Authors and Composers, which is much smaller. But with millions of music pieces being performed all over the place, radio, live, television, here, there, it would become a nightmare to try, as an individual owner of a song, to go running around like a chicken without my head, trying to find out who's playing my music and where, and threatening to sue them. Now I have organizations. and they have the they can start lawsuits. They can license for me, and this became a significant economy of scale for everybody involved. So how does this work? The members, or the, let's say the composer and the lyricist, assign certain performance rights, the small performing rights. Okay, we're going to distinguish small and grand, by the way. Small means non-dramatic, you know, mute radio, bands, concerts, things of that nature. So they assign these performance rights to ASCAP and BMI. ASCAP and BMI then deal with the users out there and license on behalf of the composer and lyricist. Who are users? Television networks, local television and cable broadcasters, radio station, restaurants, hotels, theaters, bars. Now, the primary license that's in effect is known as the blanket license, as I alluded to. Anybody know why it's called blanket?
Covers everything.
Everything that ASCAP has, or if it's with BMI, all of our songs, you're free to use. Okay? You're licensed for everything. That's the blanket license. Then there was also known as a per program license. Meaning, listen, I'm doing a show. I would like to license music for this show or for this concert that I'm giving in Hofstra. But otherwise I don't want, you know, full rights or yearly rights. I want it for that program. Also known as a per use type license. I just give me a license for this particular use. Now, after deducting their operating costs, which have been estimated, of course, their operations are private and internal, but it's estimated that they take about 20% off as revenue. They then, ASCAP and BMI, then distribute the license fees to their members. ASCAP represents about 55,000 writers and publishers, and as it has a repertory of about 3 million songs. BMI has about 130,000 writers and publishers, a larger number, but their repertory is only about 2 million songs because they're not as old an organization as ASCAP. So how do they give out this money? Okay. What they do is they survey. Samples are taken of performances on network and local television stations, local radio stations, live concert halls, nightclubs, and even background services like Muzak. Sometimes they ask for lists of what's been performed. Other times they just have people working who tune into stations and make a list of songs and see what songs are being played. Then somehow they take all of this data and they weigh it. Your song was played 10,940 times. Your song was played 3,202 times. So somehow yours is weighted like three times as much as the payment is yours. And they do this with all of these songs. And don't ask me exactly how, because I'm not there and I don't know and they won't tell you. But then they weigh all of these uses of their various member songs and they then chop up and allocate whatever money they've made after their overhead is covered, and that becomes your ASCAP or your BMI royalty. And again, they also were very aggressive in bringing lawsuits against organizations or entities that were not paying for licenses. And they would go after them and sue them for copyright infringement. Okay, is everybody following me so far? This is the small performance license, probably the most valuable right in the music repertory. Now, the blanket license, which sounds very lovely on the surface, oh, it's very convenient, I can get everything, one license, has had a lot of legal challenge through the time. It's been buffeted around. Why? It's been challenged on antitrust grounds any number of times. Blanket license is convenient, but because it produces a pooling of copyrights by members, that also improves their leverage vis-a-vis the licensees. and the Department of Justice began to scrutinize the practices of ASCAP and BMI to evaluate compliance with the antitrust laws. The government ultimately filed suit against ASCAP and BMI in 1941, alleging that the membership of both organizations conspired to restrain trade in violation of the Sherman Act, because they were essentially setting these fees, and the user said that this is the blanket license fee. You don't like it? Don't use the music. The thrust case with ASCAP and BMI secured from their members the right to be the exclusive licensor of public performance of their songs. If you didn't go through ASCAP and BMI and pay their license fees, whatever they established, you couldn't use their music. ASCAP and BMI quickly settled the suits against them by entering into consent decrees with the government. In exchange for certain limitations on their licensing rights, ASCAP and BMI were permitted to continue offering blanket licenses. They were required to open up their membership to any songwriters with published songs, and they had to distribute their revenues on a non-discriminatory basis. They were also required that you could only give non-exclusive rights to ASCAP and BMI. The songwriters had to be deemed to retain the rights themselves to grant these rights, so that somebody could approach them directly or their music publisher rather than having to rely only on ASCAP or BMI. That's known as direct licensing. I don't want to go through ASCAP and BMI. I want to call up the composer, get him on the phone, and negotiate myself. It also required ASCAP and BMI to offer per-program licenses and per-composition licenses, meaning I only want one song. I don't want the whole repertory. I don't want to pay for 3 million songs. I want one song for the year. So, essentially, the government created an environment in which ASCAP and BMI had less power to control what the rates would be. And then this decree was then re-examined again in 1950 after a lot of complaints and was amended. And what happened was a judicial mechanism was set up to evaluate ASCAP and BMI rates for their blanket license. If a licensee felt that the blanket rate was too high, they had to go the right to go to the consent decree court. In this case, it was the Southern District of New York, and say, go to the court and say, we think that ASCAP and BMI are overcharging us. We're petitioning you for a lower rate. And that was available to users to protest. Then the movie theaters got into the act, and they started to challenge the blanket license. You see, they needed performing rights in movie theaters because the movies they were showing had music. Okay? Until the late 1920s, by the way, the silent movies that were shown on screen were accompanied by live music being played in the theater by a pianist or an orchestra hired by the theater owner. Then came the talkies, and then the music was synchronized in the movie, and they got synchronization licenses. But then the movie theater said, wait a minute, there's a synchronization license to put the music in the movie, and then when it gets into the theater, they're demanding a performance license on top of it, a second license. Okay? Because when the music was commissioned, remember, it was often done as work for hire by the movie companies. Usually, though, they allowed the producers of the films to retain synchronization rights in the music and to give that back to the composer. Because the composer really said, okay, you can put it in the movie, but I like to retain my music rights. So what would happen is they pay the composer much less money up front. Say to the composer, don't worry about it. I'm going to give you all your rights back except for the right to use it in the film. Then the composer list would go to ASCAP and say, okay, when the movie goes out, hit him on the other end, get the theater owner, and charge him another license. This lasted until 1948 in a case called Alden Rochelle versus ASCAP, Southern District, in which the judge found this practice to be a violation of the antitrust law. And not only did the judge bar ASCAP and by implication BMI from selling blanket licenses to theaters, he ordered producers to keep or secure from ASCAP members the performance rights for the film's music as they were already doing with the synchronization license. In other words, what the court said is, forget about these shenanigans. When a synchronization license is granted for the movie, it must include the right to perform that movie. No double license being required. Get it all in at the same time. Then another set of attack came on the blanket license, this time from television. TV networks first, then independent stations later, sued that the blanket licenses being granted on television were a violation of the antitrust laws, that there was price fixing by ASCAP and BMI, but they lost. ASCAP and BMI won those challenges. Then cable television came in and said, this is ridiculous. We're being not mistreated by ASCAP and BMI. This is an antitrust violation. And here the case was through to the viewer issue. You remember with cable, or maybe you don't because we didn't have television yet, you would have a signal that went from the originator of the program to some kind of a head end in the town or the area, and that head end would then distribute that signal to all of the individual homes and TV units. ASCAP and BMI took the position you needed two licenses, one to go up, and then another one to go to the viewer. Okay? The cable tablers said, that's a crock. What kind of nonsense is that? I got to pay twice to get the same program? That's the way the system works. It's got to go from here up to the satellite, from the satellite down, and then it's got to go to everybody's individual home by wires. That's one view. That's one path. That's one license. And this went to court. And what happened is the court ruled that ASCAP and BMI must grant a through-to-the-viewer license. One license. Otherwise, it was a violation of antitrust laws.
What were the two licenses
going to get? I don't know if they had a name. One license was to transmit it up to the satellite. And then the second one was, well, these people are now going to distribute it to you. That's a second transmission.
Okay, they were named. Okay.
Yeah, I don't forget the names of them. Okay. So both ASCAP and BMI were required to offer traditional over-the-air radio and television networks a single performance license through to the viewer. Can't have separate licenses. Same thing with networks. Remember, networks would transmit their signals to their affiliated stations, who would then get the signal over to you. They said, no, none of that nonsense. That's one license. Okay. And then the next issue that came up more recently is the downloading issue. Okay, downloading music from the internet. Do you need an ASCAP or BMI performance license to download music? In February of 2007, ASCAP sued in federal court in New York, asking the court to rule that downloading music is a public performance for which the songwriter and publishers should be paid a license fee. AOL, Real Networks, and Yahoo responded to the case that downloads are not public performances and that ASCAP has no right to demand that they pay public performance royalties for downloads. Now, digital music services were already paying songwriters and their publishers a royalty for streaming and downloading songs. They pay the performing rights organizations, including ASCAP, a royalty for streaming songs, that means you're listening to it, okay, on your computer, and they pay songwriters a royalty for downloading songs, but didn't feel that required an ASCAP performing license, unlike streaming music. Okay? But we're paying essentially a mechanical royalty of 9.1 cents for the right to download a song. But ASCAP was saying, yeah, okay, that's very nice. We're glad you're paying the composers, but now you got to pay us for them an additional performance royalty. This was accused as being an unfair double dip attempt on the part of ASCAP. ASCAP says, well, but if you listen to the song on the radio, you got to get an ASCAP license, okay? Or you listen, I hear the song on television, you got to get an ASCAP license. So, why should this be any different? Now you've downloaded the song so you can listen to it. But the court said there's a huge difference. To perform a work means to, according to the court, citing the statute, is to recite, render, play, dance, or act it, either directly or by means of a device or process. No one disputes that when a song is broadcast on the radio and it plays on the radio, that's a device and that's a performance. But when you download a song, you don't hear the music until it downloads. And you make a decision to play that download back. If this is considered a performance, they argue, then the distribution of CDs at stores. People buy a CD in the store, they take it home, they put it in their player later, they listen to it. Now should ASCAP say that has to get an ASCAP light? That's now a performance? Yeah, even ASCAP didn't go that far. So the court said this is not the same thing as playing something on the radio or television. A download is closer to being like a CD, and it is not a public performance. So ASCAP was handed a defeat on that, so that you don't have to pay a double license. But you can see how powerful ASCAP and BMI as players have become, how much money is involved, how much litigation has been involved between the television and radio industries and even the film industry against ASCAP because of the charges that have been made for public performance. And it is very, very lucrative. Perhaps the most successful money-making creation in the entertainment industry. You remember Merv Griffin? Remember Merv, right? He died a year ago. He received a royalty, and I guess his estate still does, every time the Jeopardy theme is played on television. You know, when you have the final Jeopardy question, dun 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 dun. And how long that jingle is? 30 seconds. Every time that's played on television, he gets money through ASCAP or BMI. He wrote that jingle, by the way. He composed it in under a minute. 30 seconds of music. Back in 2005, Griffin conjectured, because we don't know for sure, he conjectured that he had made between $70 and $80 million just on playing of that jingle on television. That's performance, small performance rights income. For that one jingle, $70 to $80 million. All right, let's conclude the types of music rights and licenses with grand performing rights. Anybody want to venture? What is a grand right as opposed to a small right? If I gave you a synonym for grand, as it often used, then it will help you. What if I said dramatic performance right? Yes?
More standard, like a concert?
No, that would be a small. Concert would be a small performing right. Grand means you've taken the music and you've set it in a dramatic context, such as a musical or an opera. Okay? Where the song is now part of a dramatic work. that's being performed. You go to the theater, the song is being performed live, but it's a grand right. ASCAP and BMI do not have grand rights. You have to go to the music publisher or the composer directly for grand rights. And grand rights are defined on page 4 of your prima. Public performance rights can be broken down into two categories, small or non-dramatic on the one side, that's what ASCAP and BMI license, or grand or dramatic rights on the other. Grand performance rights cover a performance of music in a dramatic setting or in a way that advances the plot of the production. Okay? Think musical. That is your best thing to keep in your mind to understand what a grand right is. Okay. That is an overview. Mechanical royalty, small performance rights, synchronization license, grand rights, terminology that you should be facile. Yes?
For grand right, you said taking the song and making it a part of...
of a dramatic work. Okay, performing it in a dramatic context. So in answer to your question, if I'm at a concert and I'm a band or a singer and I'm a tuxedo and I'm in front of a microphone, that would be a small performing right. But if I'm in costume, for example, and I'm in a show and I'm belting out the same song and it's part of dramatic action, that would be a grand right. Next. You will see in your material a music publishing flowchart. Okay, please turn your prayer book to that page. I did this myself. When I first did this, I did this by hand. It was much more artistic looking when I did it, but then my secretary decided it didn't look nice enough and helped me put this together. So let's see if we can look at this together and see how music rights work. You have the writer with the composer and the lyricist right here in the middle. To the left side of your page, you'll see that they affiliate with a particular performing rights society, whether it's ASCAP, BMI, or CSAC, which then licenses the small performance rights. You see that on the left side. And then in boxes, it said, what are examples of that? Radio, television, you don't have such?
Cut off in the book. I don't know if
it's cut off.
Yeah, I don't know if ever it's
from the right side.
Yeah.
Look,
I thought that it was just.
It should have been printed in the
other way. Yeah, and then printed the screen.
All right, well, I don't know how to do this, but. All right, well, let me explain it. Is the left side cut off, too?
No.
All right, so I'm still on the left. Okay. So I'm the writer. I enter an agreement with ASCAP or BMI, and they will then do all of the small performance licensing for me. Then if you go to the very left, you see arrows going up. They're going to give 50% of that income to me, and they're going to pay 50% of that to the music publisher who's on the right side. Okay? So you have to have a music publisher. It could be your own music publishing company or a third party. But ASCAP pays 50, half of the money it makes for your song to you and the other half to the music publisher, and it pays you directly your money, not through the music publisher. Okay? So that's the left side of the chart. The right side, which you're telling me is cut off, I, at the same time that I have my ASCAP BMI agreement on the left, have an agreement with my music publisher on the right, who's going to handle all of the other rights in the music other than the small performing. The mechanicals, the synchronization, maybe grand, depending if I give them those rights, and the sheet music. That's what my music publisher does for me. It will then pay me royalties for those rights that it grants. That's probably what's getting cut off on the bottom. I gave uses of what you can do with music, and you're going to have a contract, which we're going to come to in a moment, with your music publisher, in which they're going to slice up that money with you. Okay? But so remember, you have the Small Performing Rights Society doesn't go through the publisher. I go through with them myself. but the publisher will get half of that because they will have an agreement with the same performing rights society. But my agreement with my publisher is going to determine how all other money is whacked up between me and my publisher. Okay. Is that clear to everybody? Questions? I'll take as many as you have.
I'm a little confused how the middle part between the publisher and the performing rights society.
Okay. Remember when I said that I have to, I'm the writer. I have to belong to a publishing rights society. The publisher, my publisher's got to belong to that same society to get paid. They will only pay me half the money. They will pay the other half to my publisher. So my publisher's got to be an ASCAP member. If I'm a BMI member, my publisher's got to be a BMI member. Okay? Most of your big publishers have ASCAP branches and BMI branches, so they belong to both. But all I'm saying is, whatever, if I'm arm in arm with ASCAP, my publisher's got to have a separate agreement with ASCAP to split my money 50-50. Aside from small performing rights, everything else is between me and my publisher. And that then becomes my battle in a publishing agreement with my music publisher, which is what we're coming to next. I hope this came out. The Songwriters Guild of America popular songwriters contract. You all have that. It probably came out, though, very small. Okay. This is what this contract looks like. The reason why I gave you this one is because this is sort of a guild of songwriters that you can belong to. And one of the services of the organization was to draft a contract that was more songwriter-friendly. If you go to the various music publishers, they don't want to see this form of contract. Each publisher, EMI, Warner Chappell, whoever they are, for music, they have their own forms. And they would love to use their forms because, like everything else we've done in this course, when you have contracts, they have contracts that favor the publisher. This group of songwriters said, wait a minute, we're going to come up with a contract that's more user-friendly for the songwriter. If you have enough bargaining clout, you say to the publisher, I want to use a songwriter's guild publishing agreement. If you don't, the publisher says, shut up, here's my form, you can look at it, maybe I'll let you make a change or two if you're nice, but I don't use their form, we have our pretty form. But all of them will cover the same issues. Okay, and that's what I want to do to finish off the music part. So I'm going to walk you a little bit through this document to show you how it works and what the issues are in your negotiation with your music publisher. Having said that, the Songwriters Guild offers you another option. And if you don't even need them, you can do it yourself. You can set up your own publishing company. So I can set up Robert Harris, Inc. as a music publisher, and I'll affiliate with ASCAP. And I can then be my own publisher, take that 50% income from ASCAP, and not share this money with anybody. You can do that. Of course, the music publisher will tell you, but you don't know what the hell you're doing, and we can do it much better, and we can promote it, and get your music out there, and get it. We have contacts, and we can get it recorded, and we can push it, and blah, 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 that you can't do yourself. But I just wanted you to be aware that there's no legal requirement that you go to a third-party publisher. You can have your own, so you can self-publish. Okay, let's turn to this document for the next 10 minutes. Starts off at the top by identifying the parties. There's going to be somebody called the publisher, and then there's a writer. And it may be more than one writer because it may be a collaboration, it may be a joint work. You may have a composer and a lyricist. I mean, you can have three composers. You can have five lyricists. It could be anything. So we have to identify, and I've emphasized this in every contract we've looked at, that we have to be very clear in the beginning. We always want to identify our parties very clearly. Then we have, in paragraph one, if you look at the fourth word, what do you see? What word? Louder?
Assigns.
Assigns. This is an industry, and I don't know exactly why, but historically it has been the case that the music publishers get an assignment of the copyright. The copyright doesn't stay with the writer. The copyright gets transferred over to the music publisher. Now, this is even on the Songwriters Guild form. This is not a publisher's form. But that's just the way the industry works. The music publisher takes the copyright. It's different from book publishing. It's different from theater. And it's not a work for hire. So it's not the same as television or movies, which get the copyright through a work for hire. This is an individual work, but it is assigned and transferred to the publisher. Are you with me? And then we identify the name of the composition and what that means. Then the next issue is the term. How long does the publisher get these rights? How long is the assignment for? Well, in a normal publishing agreement would be the life of the copyrights. Total assignment of the copyright. Under the copyright statute, and I know we didn't go into this much because it's very complicated, there is a recapture right after 35 or 40 years, depending on whether it's published or not. What the Songwriters Guild Agreement does in paragraph 1 is it automatically, even if you don't exercise your rights under the copyright statute, will transfer and revert the copyright back in 40 years from the date of the contract, or 35 years from when it's released commercially, whichever first happens. So it builds in a reversion that no other publishing agreement will give you. Any other publisher's agreement will be life of the copyright, period. That's all covered in paragraph 1. I'm going too fast, just holler or throw something. 2. We have to know what performing rights society we're affiliated with. I'm going to tell you, I'm an ASCAP member, a BMI member, or a CSAC member, so that the publisher makes sure we're in this together. We identify that. And then it says clearly, ASCAP and BMI money don't flow through this contract. Remember I showed you, it does not flow through the music publishing. ASCAP and BMI are going to pay me my money directly. And they're going to pay the publisher its 50% share directly. It's not going to go through the... I don't have to rely and chase my publisher for my ASCAP and BMI money. And that is reconfirmed in this contract. Next, paragraph 3 is a warranty, which you would expect. Publisher wants the composer to warrant the lyricist that this is an original work, that it doesn't infringe somebody else's copyright. Okay. Next, we start the guts of the money. All of 4 going down the rest of that page is what royalties, what am I going to be paid, Mr. Publisher, from your exploiting my song? You're going to bring in money. Well, how are we going to divvy this up? So we talk about, is there an advance? You see in 4A, I'd like some money on signing this contract for giving you my song. And that's negotiable. Then we go into sheet music, because that's really the oldest, and maybe that's why it's here. How many pennies or what percentage are you going to tell me of the selling price when you sell folio books and piano books and sheet music? Okay, foreign royalties. Then, and we're still dealing with print here, going down A, B, C, D, E, F, until we get to G. So most of this is all dealing with crummy sheet music stuff. Then you get to G, and that's your mechanical royalty. Now that's money, okay? And every time the song is recorded, or even if it's downloaded, you're going to get these mechanical royalties. The typical split in the industry is 50-50. Publisher keeps half, pays the half to you. Okay. You see, synchronization is mentioned there too. Again, typically 50-50. If we get $100,000 for licensing our song in a movie, I get 50, you get 50. All right. Then it talks about deductions for Harry Fox. If they're going to use a licensing agent like the Harry Fox office, they're going to charge some money. It's got to be paid off the top. Okay. Let's turn the page. television uses, okay, writers consent to licenses. There are things like grand rights, which we talked about, and maybe some other use in a commercial where you say, hey, you know, Mr. Publisher, Ms. Publisher, I don't want you just granting rights to use my song in a commercial because, you know what, maybe I don't like the product. I don't know if I want my song in a Viagra commercial. I just don't know that I want to do that. So even though you have the rights, I'm putting on certain holds on your rights that you've got to get my approval. Remember, that goes under which letter of the four C's?
Control.
I don't want you to do that. Maybe I want to approve what movie you put it in. Or you want to put my stuff in a play or a musical? You got to ask me first. Or I want to reserve all of those rights. I'll control my own grand rights, thank you. That all gets covered in this section. Yes?
So when an artist registers with ASCAP, are they automatically giving them 50% interest in their work?
ASCAP? Yeah, well, the ASCAP money, after ASCAP takes off its administration fees and then goes through this voodoo of weighing your song against others, whatever money it makes, whatever dollar it makes, 50 cents goes to the writer, 50 cents goes to the publisher. Automatically, separate payment. I don't have to go through my publisher to get that. It goes through separately on the left side of the chart. I deal with ASCAP and BMI. Okay. L is underneath it is trust, meaning it's, when they until they pay me the money, it's my money, even though they haven't paid it to me yet. Then credits. How my credit should appear, that's in N. Then 5 is if we have more than one writer, how are we divvying the money? Is 50% going to the composer and 50% to the lyricist? Maybe the composer is getting 70% and the lyricist is getting 30%, or vice versa. That has to be covered. Then there's an interesting clause in 6, which you won't see in many publishing agreements, that basically says, hey, publisher, if you don't get my song covered and recorded by a certain time, I can yank this contract back from you and take my rights back because you haven't done your job. Most publishers don't want to give you that, but it's in the Songwriters Guild Agreement in 6. Okay. Let's now flip over to the next page. Royalty statements in 10. How often are you going to account to me, publisher? Once a year, twice a year, once a decade, once a century? How often am I going to get my money? And I want statements showing you how you calculated my royalties. Paragraph 11 is, you know something, maybe I don't know if you did it right. I want to have the right to inspect your books and send an accountant in there and audit you. That's an 11. It's a pretty big provision. Paragraph 12 is a default provision saying, hey, if you're in breach of this agreement and you don't cure that breach within a certain period of time, I can terminate this agreement and take my rights back. That's a very important right when you're licensing or signing something out and you're getting payments from the other guy and they're screwing up and not paying you or otherwise violating your rights. You want to have a right to get out of that contract. And that's paragraph 12. Paragraph 13 deals with derivative works and says, here's another control issue. You can't use my song and let somebody else play with it, manipulate it, and make it into a new song without my permission. And then 15 deals with lawsuits and infringements, 15 and 16. And going to the last page, damages, infringement, arbitration in 17. Instead of going to court, you can arbitrate any disputes. 18 says, publisher, you can't sell this stuff off to somebody I don't know and so that I'm in bed with another publisher unless I give you approval. And special provisions and social security number stuff on the bottom. But these are essentially the issues that go into every music publishing agreement. So we've had terminology. We understand how the small performing rights industry, and it is an industry, works. We know a little bit about how a music publishing agreement works and how we get paid. And that's essentially what my chart says, is that even though it got cut off on the right, These are all the types of licenses the publisher can grant. Mechanicals and syncs and print and commercials and maybe grand rights. And then money's going to flow back to me for those uses, whatever we agree to. Any questions on music? Music publishing? Music rights? If not, we'll take a break for 5 minutes and then we'll try to do whatever time we have left to do some recording stuff and look at a recording agreement. Yes? Would this help you if I pass this around? I'm sorry that came out that way. I don't know why. I never had this problem in the past. Everybody sign in. By the way, a word to the wise, the terminology in here should, it's good to know.
Remember when it was the hotel that
I killed
the back, Sometimes a contract.
It's not a contract.
They own it. It is, but it's subject to certain restrictions. I'm also getting money, too, right? So I'm getting something out, so I'm retaining rights, but I've given away the copyright, okay? I'm selling you my copyright, okay, in my lecture notes. But in return, contractually, you agree to pay me a royalty every time you use it, and if you want to use it in an integrated production, you got to come back and ask me if it's okay. And I, by contract, I delimit your rights, even though I'm no longer the owner of them. I now have a contractual right.
You give them the rights with restrictions for consideration.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Right, but I mean, I've turned over the copyright, but I've also imposed certain obligations on that copyright.
Now, if you're big enough, like Bruce Springsteen, I would imagine.
Right.
I'm publishing.
You don't have to be big. You can be teeny and be your own publisher.
Right, but if you're big enough.
Yeah, because you know why? Because why should I give away 50% of everything to another publisher? Unless you believe the publisher's doing something.
But then sometimes you can sell to the publisher cheaper. Instead of 50, I'll let you publish for 25.
Sometimes, yes. If you have enough bargaining. Okay. Let's go on to the poor recording industry, which is in the throes of turmoil and upheaval and claiming that they're going to have to go out of business because technology is moving such that it has overturned the whole recording market. And even before all of this, I had some statistics that less than 15% of all sound recordings released by the major record companies ever make back their costs. About 5 years ago, there were close to 40,000 albums released, 7,000 from the majors and about 32,000 independent record labels. Only 288 of those 40,000 or so sold over 250,000 units, and only about 400 some odd sold over 100,000 units. That means that less than 1% of the time for the total recording industry, an album return makes significant sales in terms of recouping its costs and maybe turning a profit. A typical album released by a major label would often cost in excess of $300,000, plus an advance for the recording artists, which often ran in a couple of $100,000. Then you had to have several $100,000 of marketing, promotion, publicity, you know, advertising, videos, then a distribution and tour support for the artist sometimes. And in total, the overall costs for a single album released by a major often ran over $1 million. Based on the odds I just gave you, it's highly unlikely the label breaks even on its investment. And that's the good part. Things got a lot worse because album sales have been plummeting. Let's stop now and just go through some of the highlights of a record contract. And I have a form here that's, you know, it's a 1999 form, and these are thick, heavy contracts. And the reason they are because they are intended to confuse you and make it almost impossible for you to understand the Zuntite, how it works, how to figure out what your royalty is. And we're going to go through that in a couple of minutes. But let's start with paragraph one, with the term. And you have to factor in paragraph 12. Paragraph 1 says you got a term, you got to deliver an album within a certain period of time. Then you get 7 separate options for more. And it looks like, does that mean it's 7 years? Then you go to paragraph 12 on page 20 of the contract. And it says you can't perform services for making records for anybody else during the time of this contract. And this has always been a sore point because relations often sour between the recording artist and the record company. And the record company seems to have a hold with 7 separate options for 7 more albums after the first one. And it looks like you're in bed with these people forever. And this has, in fact, been challenged in court. In 2000, a multi-million dollar lawsuit was brought by Universal against Courtney Love for breach of contract because she allegedly tried to terminate a 7-year contract without delivering 5 recordings that she still owed to the company. In other words, she had delivered 2. Courtney Love was a well-known rock singer of the band Hole. Not long after filing the lawsuit for breach of contract, Love countersued, demanding an end to the industry-wide practice of offering only long-term contracts like this. The suit got a lot of attention at the time. That reason was because right at the turn of the century, the state of California was holding hearings about the recording industry and about the way recording artists were treated and being held to long-term contracts. Love was one of the first artists to file a lawsuit to void her contract under the California label law. After 2 years of wrangling, Love and Universal reached a settlement. The outcome was viewed at the time as a major victory for Love. The terms of the agreement included allowing her to retain ownership of her unreleased recordings, and the label waived the re-recording restriction for some of the previous recordings, and she was free. The country group Dixie Chicks also entered the headline a few years ago with a lawsuit against their recording label, Sony, over their contract. In the summer of 2001, the group attempted to get out of their contract with Sony, claiming shoddy accounting practices and underpayment of royalties. The label counterclaimed that the group owed them more albums pursuant to those options, and there would be a substantial financial loss if those albums were not delivered. The Chicks claimed that their contract was structured in such a way as to virtually enslave them, obligating the group to continue to record no matter how blatantly the label breached its obligations, that they were still being held to these multiple recording requirements. The group testified before the California State Legislature to address the fairness in recording practices in California. The case was eventually settled, and although there was a confidentiality agreement in place, it was reported that the settlement included a $10 million advance, an increase in royalty rate, and a new label called Open Wide Records that would be put out for them. Now, why do you think that there are 7 separate options in here? Why not 3? Now, why not 18? Anybody? You've got to know California statutory law. Under the California Labor Code, a personal service contract cannot exceed 7 years. As a result, the record companies try to get 7-year contracts from recording artists. Walter Yetnikoff, who was a great, used to be, and now dead, I believe, mogul in the recording industry, was once quoted as saying, "Pay the artist as little as you can, tie the artist up for as long as he can and recoup as often as he can. I mean, that's basically the theory. Pay him as little as you can, tie him up and try to get squeeze as much out of them and try to get your money back. Okay, so that's the first issue, is how many recordings am I obligated to give, and what's the time periods in which I have to deliver them, and that 7 years can sometimes stretch off because things are not done on time or they're not accepted. So that's one major issue of contracts of this nature. Next, I want to deal with advances. Pages 5 and 6 of the contract. Baby bands, new bands, can get between $25,000 and $75,000, all negotiable. Established, groups can get anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000, and superstars can get, stars as far as, numbers going way, way up as far as advances. But understand that the advances that are paid are recoupable against the the royalties under the record agreement. So until the record company earns back those advances, it will not pay any royalties. Similar to what other industry? Well, yes, theater, and what else close to the book industry? Remember, if the book, the author gets an advance, the author's not going to get a royalty until that advance has been earned out.
And for a record album, it would be against the mechanical rights, right? At 99 cents.
No. The royalty here is what we're talking about in a record contract.
Oh,
the royalty is that you're paying to the performing artist.
Okay.
These performing artists may not own their own music. They may not get a mechanical royalty. And if they do own their own music, yes, their music publishing deal, the music publisher that allowed the use on that record album is going to get a mechanical. But right now I'm talking about what the performers are getting.
Okay.
On
so on an album, you got to sell enough albums to recoup.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Different.
Okay. Exactly right. Then paragraph 6 on the next page, the master recording, which is the embodiment of this recording from which copies can be made. Typically, in contracts of this nature, the record company will own the master, will own the sound recording, including the sound recording copyright, usually claim that it's a work for hire, because they're mixing the sounds and all of the contributions are coming together, so that ownership generally goes to the record company. Now, if you are the artist, you want to make sure your stuff gets out there, right? You want to make sure the recordings get out. Paragraphs 705 on page 8. How long does the record company have to try to get the record out? Because remember, we had this in book publishing. When does the book have to be published? And if you look in 705A, it looks like 6 months plus a 30-day grace period to give notice, or 60 days. It looks like maybe it's that long. But if you go to the next page, it also tags on time. If the expiration date is between such and such dates, we tag on more period of time. So you got to read this stuff carefully to see what is the commitment to release the recording by what time. And you may have to, say, go through more than one paragraph to figure it out. To say, this is a very, very lengthy contract, and I'm not going to go through more than that with you, except now to give you an example of how you have to read and understand things carefully, and that a term such as a royalty or, ooh, you're getting a 16% royalty, which is also another way of saying that is 16 points. Get 16 points. So you go back to your client. We got a record deal here. You're getting 16 points, 16% royalty. Okay? That sounds good. But I gave you, I believe, a handout at the end of this contract with a little calculation sheet. Did I not? Yes, do you have such in your book? Okay, I want to talk to you about that a little bit. See what's going to happen to those 16 points and how you're going to have to run through the turn pages, which you're not going to do now, and go through this contract and try to figure out how do they calculate this? And like the movie business and net profits, which we're going to talk about next week, and then at the end of the course, you try to figure out how they've come up with this and what the number is. Let's just go through this a little. Here we have an agreement, and the basic U.S. royalty rate, that's what it starts off, the basic U.S. rate is 16 points on records sold through normal commercial channels. Now, all of this is important because these words mean something, and they mean not what you think they mean, they mean what the contract says they mean. So you have to find out, and it's defined in here, in certain places, there may be a definitional section, it may be in the royalty section, it may be cross-referenced somewhere 50 pages away. What is a U.S. basic royalty rate? And what does it mean, sales through normal commercial channels? Well, maybe most of your stuff is not going to be sold through normal commercial channels. Okay. So we're going to start off with these beautiful 16 points, or 16% royalty. 16% royalty rate on record sales through normal commercial channels. And what is this based on? The suggested retail list price, which also has to be defined in the agreement, not what you think that means. Okay. And in this particular case, let's assume that that price is $17.98. CDs have come down a lot now, but let's go with this because that's how I did this math once. Okay. If you multiply 16% times this, you come out with $2.88, right? I'm going to get $2.88 for every copy sold of this record, right? Now, if this is your first deal, you say, wow, you negotiated a very nice deal. All right. However, it's not going to come out anywhere near 16%, and you're not going to wind up with $2.88 per copy. Let's see why. What about a CD that sold? Section 805A of the agreement, trust me, you can look at it later, says that the CD royalty rate, if it's a CD, is only 85% of the otherwise applicable rate. Why? Because they say so. Because when the industry came out and CDs came out, was like 15 years ago, 20 years ago, anytime something's new, it's always, oh, we can't pay you on a regular rate. No, we'll pay you on a share. So that, you've now reduced your rate down to 85 cents. Okay? So, the U.S. basic royalty rate now is really not 16% anymore. It's 14. And that number now has dropped. Correct? But then section 8.01 of the agreement provides that this new applicable rate, this now I'm down to 14%, is applied to the applicable royalty base. Now you go to paragraph 13.28A1 that tells you what is a royalty base for U.S. sales. And that says, is suggested retail price, right? At this price, less taxes and less container charge. If you go to paragraph 13.07 of the agreement, it's 25% times $17.98, which is $4.50. So there's a $4.50 container charge. Okay? What is a container charge? Anybody know the history of container charges?
The plastic wrap, that's something in the container which it comes in, plus any marketing materials to put in that.
That's cute, but no. Container charge. Container charge, believe it or not, came from Shellac Records. Nobody here is old enough to remember Shellac Records. But remember, you can remember long playing records, LPs. I hope so, please. Remember LPs? They're made out of plastic. Back in the 20s and 30s, they were made out of shellac. What happened when they were shipped? Often.
They broke?
They cracked or broke. So the record industry says, hey, listen, you know, we got a breakage rate here. It's like 25%. The stuff breaks. We got to lower it. We've got to have a container charge of 25%. So I ask you, ladies and gentlemen, does it happen with tape? What was the before CDs? What was the tape called?
The
eight track tape. No cassette. Do CDs break? No. But it's part of the history. As a result, they insist on taking every record company takes a container charge. Okay? Does it make sense? No, but they do. So we have $17.98, and that container charge we calculated is $4.50. That has now made the price $13.48. So I'm at 14% of $13.48 instead of 16% of $17.98. And I've gone through about seven or eight parts of the contract, and my head is spinning already, right? So the basic U.S. royalty rate is $1.8872 compared to, so I've lost now, already lost the buck so far. I'm not finished. Okay. Keep in mind, so that's only comes out to, by the way, 65% of $2.88. I'm getting 65% of red less now of what I thought I was getting. Then, remember I told you in paragraph 5, recoupment of recording cost advances. Supposing you had advances totaling $200,000. No royalty is payable until approximately 106,000 units are sold. That's $200,000 divided by 1.8872. I need to sell 106,000 units before you begin to see a royalty. Okay. Also, paragraph 9.04 defines records sold and free goods. And paragraph 10.01 gives the record company the right to maintain a reserve. Okay? And free goods, they often have something like, well, we only account on 90%, because 10%, yeah, you got to give away for promotion. So I'm only going to get 90% of this. Then, you remember in the book publishing we talked about, and they said, you know, a lot of people return the books. They can take up to 50% of their sales and hold them and say, you know, a lot of CDs come back. We don't sell them. So we can't account to you on at least half of the stuff until maybe a year or two later. You got to be careful about the language there to make sure they eventually dissolve those reserves and pay you the money. Okay? So I'm paying on 90% of 100, so I'm already down for free goods to about $1.70. Plus, there's a reasonable reserve and returns about 50%, which means I'm probably going to be accounted for about 85 cents until they eventually tell me how many of them they didn't sell. Now, we're still not done. There are reductions in the basic royalty rate, because that only applies to normal U.S. channels. Well, we need to look at other definitions which reduce that. For example, paragraph 8.02, if you notice, lowers the rate in Canada, the United Kingdom, and Japan, and the rest of the world. The Canadian rate is at 75%. The U.K. and Japan is at 66 2/3. And the rest of the world is 50%. So they automatically lower this outside for sales outside the United States. Paragraph 8.03 covers sales through record clubs. The rate is reduced again for record clubs. 804, what about budget sales, mid-price sales? Very often, most of the sales take place in regular, normal, customary U.S. channels.
Okay, now, again, this is too complicated to go through. Now, how many sections or paragraph numbers have I mentioned already? That you are going through and trying to read this contract. Wait a minute, what does that mean? How do they define that? Where is that section? And by the time you go through this to figure out what I've just given you here, first of all, you don't know what they're doing. And second of all, they're probably not going to follow it anyway, and you've got to find it. And thirdly, you've got to say to your client that that's 16%, and what they thought was a $200.88 may be getting them something like 85 cents. And then if it's not, if it's on budget, it may go down lower and lower. You may be getting 40 or 50 cents on that instead of close to $3. So that 16% rate may be in reality the equivalent of a 4% rate when you're done with it all. And the point here being, and I'm gonna drive this home to you again in the next couple of classes, is definitions. Terms mean what you say they mean, or what the draftsman on the other side, representing the record company or the movie studio, says that it means. And very often they make it very hard for you to understand what they mean. And that's all to their advantage, so their internal accountants can try to pay you as little as possible. So between paying back the advance here and everything else, you may never see the royalty. And if you do, you're not going to get the ethereal heights of money that you thought you were going to get. Okay. Then, by the way, 8.05B covers new technology, which is then defined in section 13.21. And the new technology, it says the rate is two-thirds of the otherwise applicable rate. So if it's not a CD and it's something new like download or other types of sales, or you're going to knock this number down, the basic royalty rate is going to be knocked down. It becomes very, very, very complicated. And I don't wish this on any of you to have to review this stuff, but you may have to if you represent recording artists. Or if you're representing a record company, you're going to have to create monsters like this. Okay? You with me? All right. Let's ease up a little and just talk about some trends and some other couple of issues. You don't know, have to know, by the way, on the exam, any of this stuff. Not going to ask you that. But if I give you a provision or a contract, I may throw a term in there, like say you're going to get a 16% royalty on record sales or something, and I may, in part of your analysis, you may say to me, I don't know what that means, or how is that calculated, or there's no definition, or I can't figure out what the 16 points mean here, and what is it based on. You know, it may not be a record thing, it may be another area, but in essence, I want you to be cognizant of the fact that when you see terminology or you see numbers, is it clear to you how the calculation is made or what it means? Because if it's not, you're in for trouble. You're in for trouble trying to figure out what it is your client is going to be paid or must pay to somebody else. I also gave you a handout of the Greenfield case, the purpose of that being where there was a transfer of rights to a master recording, and the issue came up as to whether the performers would get synchronization rights or others. There was a case where the agreement was silent as to a particular media. We've done cases like that quite a bit. Again, what happens when there's new media or where the contract is not clear as to what's covered? Just recently I read, this was in August, members of the Allman Brothers Band sued UMG Recordings over claimed royalties from digital downloads, ringtones, and CD sales, claiming digital exploitation. They were looking for $13 million in damages, and the issue, of course, is whether the performers were entitled to these revenues, whether these types of uses were covered by the contract for which they would share in a royalty.
All right, I also gave you an internet clearance chart that's a little bit on the old side now, but I think I did. Did I not? Did I give you one of those? Unless I took it out. Oh, yeah, here, an obstacle course, what you have to go through. It's very complicated. Okay. Basic trends, we're living through the decline of the CD. CD had it reigned for a while, and between the internet and piracy, it's suffering quite a bit. Everybody's wringing their hands in the record industry. I gave you an article called The Album of Commodity in Disfavor, with CD sales falling, labels seeking new deals with Apple. And everybody's clamoring to try to figure out how to handle the changes in technology. I also gave you a chart about falling album sales in the industry. Again, part of trends. 2008 album sales were down by 11% following preceding years of decline. There were rare blockbuster hits. The Carter Third, or how do you pronounce that? The Carter Roman Three.
The Carter Three.
The Carter Three. Album by rapper Lil Wayne sold 423,000 units on June 10th of this year. On the day of its release, the first week sales totaled just over 1 million units, according to Billboard. The last time an album broke 1 million sales in a single week was The Massacre by 50 Cent. I don't know who these groups are. Global digital music sales in 2006 were already in excess of $2 billion. And we have things that like ringtones, streaming video and audio on cell phones. And there are an estimated, by the way, at least in 2007, I read that it was estimated then that there were 2 billion cell phones worldwide. So everybody's scrambling for new business models. So here's some of the new stuff that I've been reading. Superstar rapper Jay-Z closed the deal with Live Nation, a leading concert promoter, for a roughly $150 million package, including financing for his own entertainment venture, in addition to recording and tours. He left his record label Def Jam. Now, Live Nation and other promoters and advertisers and record labels are scurrying to make deals that cut them into a larger share of the artist's overall revenue, and include recording distribution rights, concert bookings, merchandising, and supervision of the artist's career. They're known as 360-degree deals, meaning the record company and the artist share and work on everything together, not just the recording. Live Nation had previously made a less extensive deal with Madonna, reportedly worth $120 million, and U2. The Times article commented that the popularity of music downloads has revolutionized how music is consumed, and widespread piracy has contributed to an industry meltdown in which traditional album sales, composed mostly of the 2-decade-old CD format, reigned for 2 decades, have slumped by more than a third since 2000. The bestseller in 2000, Josh Groban's Noel, is it Noel or Noel? This idea. So 3.7 million copies compared with 9.9 million for the top album in 2000, by the way. This has pressured record label executives to rewrite the economics of their business and step beyond album sales into all these new technologies. And by the way, in an interesting postscript, I read in the Times in June that the chairman of Live Nation was negotiating his resignation after an internal battle over these deals that he had been making, that I mentioned, as to whether they were prudent or not. He was being challenged by people on the board, and Live Nation stock had been falling. Now, of course, everybody's stock was falling, but it had been falling starting back then. Another postscript from the New York Post. The New York Post recorded in July that Live Nation signed off on approximately a $70 million deal for Shakira. The Times reported that depending on her performance over the 10 years of her contract, the 10-year contract, that figure could rise to as high as $100 million. Note that Shakira still owes Sony BMG That's Epic Records, another album, and won't deliver her first album to Live Nation until late 2009 or 2010. Similarly, Madonna and Jay-Z have prior commitments and are not expected to release Live Nation albums until then. So it's a risk Live Nation is trying to tie up these artists in sort of an all-encompassing 360-degree deal, as they're called, even though they can't even record for them quite yet. I read in Variety that Nickelback has also signed a 360 deal. Commercial products companies are now joint venturing with record labels. Procter & Gamble, Red Bull, Nike, Bacardi, Unilever, and Converse are getting into the music business to promote their own products. PG joined Island Def Jam Records to form Tag Records, a label for new hip-hop acts. Okay. I'm going to let you out in a minute. The lost sales due to file sharing, the millions and billions. I have all sorts of statistics. CD prices have come down to try to compete. The RIAA, somebody mentioned RIAA before, which is a consortium of record companies. They're suing people for unauthorized downloads. Then, and the old theory, if you can't lick them, you join them. Music pay services were started, such as Apple, iTunes, Yahoo, eMusic, Microsoft, Napster Lite, Rhapsody. They charge per track or album. You would know this better than I. Some by monthly subscription. MySpace Venture, they're trying to do this as well. There's anti-piracy technology that's fallen into disfavor. Almost all the companies now are pulling out anti-piracy technology that was in their products. Finally, I'm skipping. I want to just give you one more piece of terminology that you should know because it comes up in this industry all the time. It begins with a P. Anybody want to guess the word? P. Payola. You ever heard the term? What's funny? Payola. P-A-Y-O-L-A. Anybody ever heard the term? It's paying cash or gifts. What? You pay cash or gifts to get airplay. It's the contraction of the words pay and Victrola. Victrola was the name of an old record player. The first case in 1960 involved a disc jockey, Alan Freed. It is illegal under federal law to give payola. Now, there's also another term called plugola. P-L-U-G-O-L-A, which is airtime to promote an event or an act in which a DJ has a financial interest without disclosure. In other words, a DJ plugs an act or a performance or an event in which the DJ has an interest or is getting some money. That's plugola versus payola. Terms that, you know, in the music business you will hear. It probably still goes on all over the place, but it is technically illegal. And that concludes our session for today.
Just one question. Mechanical right and royalty on an album. Maybe I'm missing something. Mechanical right, do they get 9.5 cents per album sold?
Yes. But that goes to the music, not to the performers. That's the copyright owner's royalty to the music. If they own their own copyrights, and that goes outside of the royalty. That's an expense of the record company, 9.1 cents per song per album.
Right, so it could be one of the same person.
Could be. Could be. I may play the guitar and also write my own music.
And back to Masters, it was a scene in Ray, where he tells the record company, I'm going to keep my Masters from now on, and that was a big deal.
Very few.
The Beatles did not.
No.
They did not.
Next week, which is the 13th, we'll be doing film, whatever number that is in your booklet. Everybody sign in? Selling's in here?
Represent the musicians?
No musicians, not really, no.
that's California-based industry, largely. I mean, he used to be a presence in New York. I just don't, I don't have much of a music presence.
No.
Most of my music is theater.
We're
representing composers who are being on the other side or on the same side as the theater.
Which is, in the theater, being derivative, correct?
No, it'll be music written for the theater. And cast album.
I know.
And then you write that you might get away or might not. Usually the producer gets the rights. And then you negotiate a deal with the record company, and then you go through the stuff on the cast album. So I've gone through this stuff with cast albums.
But they don't be, well,
it's an album, it's a record. Same issues. Very same. You don't have recording commitments like 7 years and things like that.
But the
money, of course, you go through. And cast albums rarely make money today. Most of them are always. Wicked is
Wicked.
One of Wicked. Spamalot made a little bit of money. But Wicked is the one major exception.
You know, I took my daughter to that in the original cast thinking that it was going to be. I didn't know what kind of
thing.
I mentioned antitrust.
Sure,
but you know, we did some law today.
I can't imagine why.
Didn't we do antitrust?
We did.
Yeah.
So you're going to take my class?
Oh,
that's excellent. Be in line, right? CBS?
Yep.
See that? Plan and licensing?
Yeah.
Ooh. These guys are experts on this stuff now.
Now y'all can take this, can stay for the antitrust.
Do you want this, Professor Harrison?
Oh, who gets this? How do you turn this off?
Somebody's come and pick it up, right?
Oh, here's stop.